All right, welcome. This is chapter 4 of Critical Conversations. My name is Robert Ambrose, and I'm here with Dar Jamail. Welcome, Dar.
Robert, great to be back again.
It is good to be back again. And we're recording at a time when there's a little bit of breathing room politically. I think we're in a little bit of a honeymoon with the new administration in Washington.
Yeah, it's nice to wake up and maybe peruse the news and not be traumatized by whatever the latest tweets are from a madman with the nuclear codes.
Yeah. And so we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the political situation in the country. Although, again, I do think it's a honeymoon period. We have some indications that whatever began on January 6th in Washington is not over with, and we will be faced with this sort of insurrection for a long time to come.
Yeah, it's far from being over. I think we're very much at the beginning of this, and I think it's important for people to kind of keep that broader perspective as the GOP has clearly become a just overtly fascistic party and becoming more so by the day. So already we're seeing voter suppression and things going on already starting for the midterms. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly a problem that is growing in the background now as we kind of have this nice deep breath period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this all may end next week when the impeachment trial begins, and that may stir up emotions nationally.
So this thankfully gives us an opportunity to take advantage of this relative hiatus in the political crisis to talk about the two things that Robert and I have been following for a long time, the COVID-19 global pandemic and the climate crisis. So Robert, you're the one of us really tracking the pandemic. So why don't you give us a good solid update on that?
Sure. Like with the political situation, there are some hopeful aspects of the situation with COVID-19. One of them being that vaccines are getting a bit more dispersed. And so we all are looking patiently and hoping that we'll be vaccinated. Just in terms of vaccinations itself, in this country, over 70 million vaccines have been administered, and there are over 1.5 million vaccinations per day. There is some hope because of the vaccinations, but let's look at the numbers in general for what impact COVID-19 has had on the U.S. and the world, really. Right now, the latest figures show that over the world, 105.6 million people have had COVID-19, and there have been 2.3 million people who have died. At least 2.3 million people have died of COVID-19 in the world. In the U.S., we have 27 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, and that may be way underestimated because for the beginning half of the year, they were hardly testing people in this country. U.S. deaths now, 460,672 people have died. We're at the beginning of February. New estimates from the University of Washington Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, the IHME, the new estimate for number of deaths in the U.S. by June 1st is a staggering 630,881.
So, Robert, give us an idea, like, comparatively to other pandemics or wars, how big a number is that compared to?
Oh, this is way more than any single war. This is the most tragic disaster in American history, I think.
Clearly.
And so even though vaccines are becoming more normalized, and probably by the end of the summer, there will be enough people vaccinated that the toll in deaths and hospitalizations will really diminish, and life may get back a little bit towards normal. But there are some worries, too. For one thing, with the vaccines, their distribution is very unequal. Like most distributions of resources, underprivileged people of color are the last ones being vaccinated. That's one danger in the vaccination scenario. Another is that there are some people that are trying to prevent vaccinations. And last week in Los Angeles, there was a group of people, and they're probably, if I had to hazard a guess, they're probably from the same group of people that were in Washington on the 6th. And they blocked access to vaccinations for several hours until police could move them away. Those are some of the risks with the vaccine distribution and how it will diminish the pandemic in the U.S. The other thing is the variants.
And now, Robert, before you talk about the variants a little bit more, I mean, I know that you've got a background qualifying you to really share with us an expert perspective on this. Can you talk briefly about your background before you talk more about the variants?
Sure. One of the reasons I'm interested in this COVID virus situation is because I was trained in my academic life to be an ecologist, and specifically in population genetics and population ecology. One thing about these variants, and variants are just genetic mutations that happen in any kind of organism whenever there's reproduction. So the thing about variants in specific with these COVID virus is that if you have a small population size, you'll still get mutations, but the probability of a mutation is very little. So you will, in a population of, say, 100 people who have COVID, you have a very slight chance of having a mutation, and mutations that are beneficial for the virus will succeed and reproduce with better success than the previous virus. If you have 100 million people that have COVID, then the population size of COVID is huge. And so it's a certainty that there will be mutations that grab hold and become new variants. And the new variants will be more successful at surviving because they will have an evolutionary advantage. So the vaccines that there are now may not work with these new mutant strains.
That is a very disconcerting piece of information, and it, you know, underscored by, you know, the lack of willingness by the previous administration to really deal with this in any kind of a positive way has really set us up and kind of created the conditions for exactly that to happen, at least right here in this country.
Well, yes, and it's pretty obvious that the places where these disconcerting variants are surging is in places that had similar governments that ignored the pandemic, like England, where the variety B.1.1.7, the variant, is a much more rapidly expanding variant. That one is predicted to be the variant most widespread in the U.S. by March 1st. But the one in South Africa, also likewise a country that really didn't address the pandemic when it started, that's a more dangerous variant for sure. And Brazil, the other country, led by a president very similar to Donald Trump. That's the situation, and that is the risks to achieving some kind of normality after COVID. But COVID isn't the only thing that's on our plate. Normality is something that may be something that we say goodbye to and have a new normal or an abnormal that's going to continue for a while.
It does feel like COVID, coupled with the political crisis in this country, really brought home this kind of requirement for all of us to kind of have a new ontology, you know, that our old ways of thinking and even perceiving are grossly outdated in this new world. And so the climate crisis, of course, being a giant factor with COVID-19, with, you know, these dramatically escalating temperatures and changing environments across the world, as well as human encroachment and loss of wildlands and all of this. All of these were the factors contributing to COVID-19 and will contribute to future global pandemics. So the climate crisis, obviously, I've been tracking this for a long time, mm-hmm. for more than 10 years now, and written about it extensively and released a...
And your great book, of course.
Well, thank you. And so, but I keep, even though I don't work as a journalist anymore, I, of course, track this. And I wanted to go over a few developments since last time we talked that there's been a lot, but these are just a few highlights. One actually was a report that came out the middle of last year. This is not new, but it came after the Secretary General of the UN called the climate crisis literally an existential threat, and specifically to humans. I don't know what louder alarm he could have said than that. It basically means here is this situation that's literally threatening the existence of human beings on the planet. Not long after he said that, it came out that updated Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change models, IPCC, that were going to be published this year, were already showing a greater sensitivity of climate to CO2 in the atmosphere. So of 31 models published at the time of this report, they showed a 3.5C warming by 2100 to be a middle-of-the-road scenario. And that's because the average land surface warming that they were predicting, they had basically upgraded it to 7C with increases of up to 14C in the Arctic. And I want to pause on that for a minute because, Robert, you know, we've both lived up in Alaska. We understand the importance of permafrost, how much CO2 and methane are stored there, and then the subsea permafrost in the shallow Arctic Ocean.
And isn't it already like 7 degrees C elevated in the Arctic?
It is, and depending where you are, it's even more than that. But we're talking 14 C, so that means, you know, not even half of that, all that permafrost is going to thaw and all of that CO2 is going to be released in methane equivalent. So that alone would as much as double the amount of CO2 already in the atmosphere. So, I mean, we need to really take that in, what this means. We're talking like full-scale catastrophic situation with these kinds of temperature increases. And some of the other state-of-the-art models, others from the U.S., even our own Department of Energy, Britain's Met Office, models from France and Canada, they showed an even greater sensitivity to CO2, whereas those other models I just cited had increased their land surface temperature scenarios to 7C. These other models were talking about 9C as a middle-of-the-road scenario, which is shocking. Mm-hmm. So that, and then more recently, in just this January 26th, in fact, a couple of different studies were published about polar melting and its consequences. So they really focused in on what's happening in Greenland and the Antarctic. And in short, they found that ice is melting faster worldwide than previous believed. And of course, greater sea level rise was anticipated from that, according to these studies. The scientists themselves publishing these studies, one of them, Dr. Eric Rigno, a co-author of one of the studies, and he's a glacier researcher at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab at UC Irvine, have all themselves said, look, we've been underestimating how much sea levels could rise. And this is according to their new publishing. So one of the studies showed that ice losses of around 760 billion tons per year from the 1990s had dramatically escalated to 1.2 trillion tons per year by the 2010s. And now, of course, this is outdated. It's accelerated, I'm sure, more than that by now. But it's also a good reason to think that the rate of ice melt will only continue to accelerate. The other study that I alluded to, it's a NASA-backed study on the Greenland ice sheet, found that no less than 74 major glaciers that terminate into the deep warming ocean waters are already being severely undercut and weakened. And so Eric Rigno, who I mentioned before, he went on to say, quote, I think this is an example that the current projections of sea level rise are conservative. As we peer below, we realize these feedbacks are kicking in faster than we previously thought.
And so that means that oceans will rise more than they expected, but it also means that oceans will rise more rapidly than predicted as well.
Both, exactly. And then if we kind of take a step back from those really specific reports and what they're saying, one man I interviewed for my book, Dr. Harold Wanless, an incredible sea level rise expert at University of Miami Coral Gables, he said, look, we're completely off the cliff. And just to cut to the chase of what he said was that he pointed out that how in the past on Earth, atmospheric CO2 varied from between 180 and 280 parts per million as the planet shifted from glacial to interglacial periods. That 100 part per million fluctuation in the atmosphere of CO2 was linked directly with about 100-foot change in sea level rise. And so he basically said, so every 100 ppm CO2 increase in the atmosphere gives us 100 feet of sea level rise. He said, this is what happened when we went in and out of the last ice age, specifically. And so I did the math in my head when I was sitting with him, and I said, so, you know, pre-industry, we had 280 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. The time I talked to him, it was up to 410. It's a little bit more than that now. And I did the math, and I said, so that's 130 ppm that we've added to the atmosphere in just the last 200 years. And he nodded. And I said, so that's 130 feet of sea level rise that's already baked into the Earth's climate system. And he just nodded.
Again.
So think about that. 130 feet baked in. And Dr. Rigno, who I just quoted, who I quote pretty extensively in the book and cite several of his studies, I think he's one of the leading glacier researchers on the planet today, has said, look, we've already lit all the fuses. We're just waiting for the bombs to go off. Mm. And so if we really get our heads around the fact that we have as much as 130 feet baked into the system now of sea level rise, once, you know, all of this ice melts, then that's something that we need to really kind of let sink in, talking about a new normal. And mm-hmm. we'll come back to that here in a minute. The last thing I wanted to add, a very, very important report that came out January 13. It's called Underestimating the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future. Dr. Paul Ehrlich is one of the co-authors of this, and I would certainly encourage people to look this up and give it a read.
And we'll put these links along with our post on the internet with this show.
And I want to read the synopsis of this. It's not long, and people can go, and I would encourage you, read the full report. It's absolutely worthwhile. And the thing is none of this information is new. This is essentially a gathering together. You know, it's heavily, heavily footnoted. They're citing, you know, one peer-reviewed study after another. And if you look at the people who are the co-authors of this and their expertise and who backed this study, the legitimacy of it speaks for itself. And they say, we report three major and confronting environmental issues that have received little attention and require urgent action. First, we review the evidence that future environmental conditions will be far more dangerous than currently believed. The scale of the threats to the biosphere and all its life forms, including humanity, is in fact so great that it is difficult to grasp for even well-informed experts. Second, we ask what political or economic system or leadership is prepared to handle the predicted disasters or even capable of such action. Third, this dire situation places an extraordinary responsibility on scientists to speak out candidly and accurately when engaging with government, business, and the public. We especially draw attention to the lack of appreciation of the enormous challenges to creating a sustainable future. The added stresses to human health, wealth, and well-being will perversely diminish our political capacity to mitigate the erosion of ecosystem services on which society depends. The science underlying these issues is strong, but awareness is weak. Without fully appreciating and broadcasting the scale of the problems and the enormity of the solutions required, society will fail to achieve even modest sustainability goals.
Yes, that I read that article too and found it really fascinating. Some of the people I actually, when I was in graduate school, I was reading their work a long time ago. But one thing that struck me also was they're not just talking about climate. They're talking about other impacts of human civilization, the things that we take for granted, like the access to foods that come from all over the world. They're talking about biodiversity and about food systems and about all kinds of things that are under incredible stress at the moment.
And this is why, even back in my book, I remember this was literally 5 years ago now, I was up in Anchorage and I was getting ready to fly out to the Pribilof Islands, where I based one of my chapters on St. Paul Island, to focus on how indigenous communities were being severely impacted by the crisis. And I met up in Anchorage with a man named Bruce Wright. He's a senior scientist with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. He'd worked for the National Marine Fisheries Service and was a section chief for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for 11 years, among numerous other pretty prestigious scientific qualifications. And he talked to me about the devastation that was happening to the food web in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. And I go into that in great detail in my book. But when we were wrapping up our interview, he said, and I'm going to quote him, he said, "Look, we're not going to stop this train wreck. We are not even trying to slow down the production of CO2. And there is already enough CO2 in the atmosphere. We are going to see the consequences, and they will be significant." And he went on to talk about the Permian mass extinction, the worst mass extinction event the planet's ever experienced, about 252 million years ago when 90% of species on Earth were wiped out. And he said, quote, "That is what we are looking at now." He kind of had my head swimming, and we talked a little bit more. And he went on to say that the Pribilof Islands were the last place that mammoths survived because there weren't any people out there to hunt them. And he said, quote, "We've never experienced this where we are headed. Maybe the islands will become a refuge for a population of humans." Now, that sounds extreme. Mm-hmm. That sounds dystopian. But I can tell you that as a climate researcher and a climate journalist and publishing story after story and publishing this book, that's not extreme. Mm-hmm. That is where we are. This is where we're headed. And anything that's not looking at it as clearly and soberly as that and behaving accordingly that's what's insane. Mm-hmm. You know, and we can use other very strong language, you know, dereliction of duty, criminal negligence for future generations. I don't think any of these are too strong a terms.
So in terms of getting back to what some people call normal or not being able to get back to normal, we need to go beyond seeking to get back to normal, and we need to seek solutions and begin the planning process for building infrastructure so that we can extend our new normal life as long as we possibly can.
You're right. And it's about what can we do for future generations of all species. And, you know, another good example, and this is holding Port Townsend's feet to the fire, you know, this progressive town that the one precinct went 90% for Bernie in the 2016 primaries. And so, you know, the vast majority of the people here are intimately aware of the climate crisis and take it seriously. Yet, how does that translate into actions where we have a city council that voted to dump millions of dollars into downtown beautification and tearing up the street and doing all this infrastructure on Water Street that's not going to exist in less than 80 years? Mm-hmm. Far less.
Right.
And so compared to the Quinault Nation out on the West Coast here, where they're already actively moving their two villages up 100 feet above sea level rise. So which of those actions makes sense? Mm-hmm. And it kind of strikes me that the indigenous people out there, having survived genocide, having survived erasure, having survived what the most powerful country in the world tried to do to them, trying to exterminate them, you know, when they see warning signs, they behave accordingly for their own survival. And they're intimately acquainted with the necessity for adaptation, deep adaptation. And perhaps that's why here, you know, this town where most people haven't been in war zones or haven't really understood what humans are truly capable of, you know, there is sort of this kind of whistling in the dark going on, like, oh, maybe we just need to go with the mid-level IPCC projections. And, you know, there are people in town here that believe that, which is, from my perspective as a researcher, the equivalent of denialism akin to flat earth people, where, look, you have the science screaming at you. Scientists are just, the reports are there, and you're actively choosing to not look at them. And that, to me, is, you know, really an egregious negligence to doing what we can do, what's in the power of our hands to do right now, at least locally, to try to set up future generations so they at least have some kind of a chance.
Wow. That's really a profound statement, and it really challenges us to think of ways that we can move forward.
And it's overwhelming. I get that. I mean, you know, I'd sit with this stuff on a regular basis. One of the things that really helps me and gives me motivation to do work and continue to try to be of service is something I learned from a friend of mine of Indigenous heritage. His name's Stan Rushworth. We're actually co-authoring a book now about Indigenous voices on all these crises. And he talks about the difference in cultures between the dominant Western culture that we're immersed in and Indigenous culture, where he said, look, we focus on doing things because it's the right thing to do. We are not results oriented. Mm-hmm. And I think part of our grief and part of our depression and all our struggles in the Western culture is that we're so results oriented. Speaking from experience, mm-hmm. you know, I've done that for years. And that's a sure way, given the gravity of what's upon us, to just pull the covers up over your head. Versus, you know, if I get up and I focus on, look, I'm obliged to be a steward of the earth and to serve future generations of all species. And I need to do that work because it's the right thing to do. Results be damned.
Yes, but at the same time, we can work with the community to foster planning to do practical things like move downtown, for example, or decommission the paper mill, which is a potential toxic explosion. So there are things that we can do as individuals to center and be a force for good, but there also can be a community response because communities are strong.
Well, and I think that's absolutely workable, and I think that that's actionable, good examples of what can be done that aren't, you know, adhering themselves to or attaching themselves to the broader, you know, the global situation. That's kind of what I'm referencing. You know, those are good examples of what we can do right here and start doing, like the paper bill, you know, with sea level rise alone, it has to be shut down. And so, and those people need to have jobs and they need, mm-hmm. they need livelihoods. And guess what? There's going to be jobs created when you have to move an entire downtown and set up different kinds of infrastructure for an entire city. So there's your jobs. So these are things that can be done. And, you know, if we can't do it here in this town with the politics here and how many people here really understand the gravity of what's upon us, if we can't do it here, where can we do it?
Right. Our discussions are meant to catalyze more discussions in the community and to catalyze working towards solutions. Thank you, Dar.
Thank you, Robert.
Critical Conversations is produced at KPTZ Port Townsend. Comments are welcome and should be sent to contactus@kptz.org. Music is from 1960 What by Gregory Porter.